Okay, I started the recorder late. We're talking about stories and what we need to know, the stories we need to know to understand each other. Okay, I'll keep going. So sometimes they're implicit, meaning that we don't name them. We just sort of assume that people know. Now, a popular way that this happens is the inside joke, right? You know, have you ever, you know, been somewhere where two or three people are laughing about something and you're like, I don't get it, right? Because you don't know the story, you don't know what happened, you don't know the experience. That's a kind of popular version of this. Scholars or people who study this call this phenomenon intertextuality. It has a big name, but you don't have to know the name to understand it because we all kind of live it. It's the time that we need to know a past story or a text or a conversation to help us understand the present one. So this summer, I went to a reunion of about, there were 50 of us that lived in Germany together for a year in college. There were about 30 of us at this reunion. It was a three-day reunion. We brought our spouses and kids, and it was really, really fun. But by the end of the 3 days, our spouses were getting pretty tired of the inside information kind of conversations. You know what I'm talking about? You've probably been there with somebody at a reunion or something. So that's intertextuality. So we know what it is. There was a famous instance of intertextuality about 18 years ago at the Academy Awards. Wait, 18 years ago? Is that right? That's what I wrote. I can't believe it was that long ago. And it involved the movie Titanic. Do you remember this movie?
Yes.
That's why I was surprised. Really? That was 18 years ago. James Cameron got up to accept his award. And at one point in his acceptance speech, maybe at the beginning end, I'm not sure, he had the Academy Award in one hand, and he raised both hands up, and he said, I'm king of the world, right? And the next day, maybe some of you know this story, he got kind of blasted by people saying that was kind of arrogant. You know, why would you say this? Well, I don't know if James Cameron is really arrogant or not. But in that particular case, it was kind of unfair to accuse him of being arrogant because it was not taken seriously the intertextuality that was going on. That James Cameron was quoting his own movie. And this is where the character Jack Dawson, I think his name is right at the front of the bow, and you know, he's experiencing kind of the wind in his hair, and he's getting to go somewhere for the first time, and he yells, you know, holds up his hands and yells, I'm king of the world. And so the moment there is not arrogance, it's joy, right? So I think we need to, you know, with that intertextuality in place, we give Cameron a little bit of grace and say that he was expressing joy there and not arrogance. So those are just some examples about what kind of in our real world today of what I'm talking about in the ancient text, and that is that in the Gospel of Luke, the writer really writes a story that you have the story on the surface level, but then you have all this intertextuality at play. And so that's what I want to talk about today. In order to interpret Luke's words correctly, we have to know the story behind the story. Okay, so a little bit of background. I'm actually writing a commentary on the Gospel of Luke, and it's going to be published in a series by Zondervan. And the goal of the series is to explore the story of God. So that's the context for what I'm talking about today. In my volume, that will mean studying the Gospel of Luke in the context of the larger story of God's people, the story of Israel. So it's a whole commentary series that's essentially looking at intertextuality, right? So that's kind of where this is coming from. And so I want to share with you today a little bit about what I've learned and would love to get your perspectives on that. So before getting into how Luke uses the Jewish scriptures or the Old Testament, I want to say a couple of words about the author. So many of you will know these things already, but I feel like it's important to say them at the beginning. One is that the author of the Gospel of Luke wrote two volumes, not just one. So he wrote the Gospel of Luke, but he also wrote the book of Acts. And the more people think about this and read it and study it, the more people feel pretty convinced that these were originally one story that, you know, went through all the way through. So keeping in mind Acts is, that's also part of the intertextuality, is knowing where the story goes after the Gospel of Luke. So you might hear me refer to Acts a couple of times. The other thing I want to say is that technically the Gospel of Luke, in terms of its author, is anonymous. The author is never named inside the text. In the second century, a label was attached and a tradition was, emerged. And it could be an accurate tradition, we don't know. But that this was written by Luke, the physician, who traveled with Paul. But we don't know for sure who wrote the text, so it's technically anonymous. Now, if it was the person named Luke who traveled around with Paul, he appears to be a Gentile. And so if you know much about the interpretation of the Gospel of Luke, it's often been thought of as the Gentile Gospel, right? The Gospel for Gentiles. So in a way, it would be kind of weird if that's true to say, oh, there's all this intertextuality with the Jewish scriptures, right? But in fact, that is the case. I mean, if you really get into and look closely at what Luke is doing, the Gospel is more Jewish than it is Gentile. And so whoever he was, he used a tremendous amount of echoes of the Jewish scriptures on nearly every page. So whether he was Gentile or Jewish, I think we have to see him as someone who was steeped in the traditions and ideas and texts of the Judaism of his time. Okay, so then one more introductory thing, and then we'll jump right in and look at things in the Gospel of Luke. One of the questions that Luke seems to be addressing in his own day is a question of identity. We talk a lot about identity today. This is a kind of hot topic, right? But it was also a topic that people thought about 2,000 years ago. And if you think about this, it kind of makes sense why this would be significant at this time. So when people first became followers of Jesus, they were all Jews who were following Jesus. And so it appears that they saw themselves as a kind of subset within Judaism. You know, maybe you have Pharisees, Sadducees, and then you have this subset. But as the message of Jesus starts going out into the Mediterranean world and you have more and more Gentiles, non-Jews, start to follow Jesus, then this makes this question of identity a little more complex. You now have Jews and non-Jews who are followers of Jesus gathering together in communities, and they're looking around at each other, and this is raising the question of who are we, right? And this seems to be one of the key questions that Luke is addressing in the way that he tells the story. And he answers this question by rooting the identity of his readers, of the followers of Jesus at this time, very deeply in the soil of Israel's history. So even though they're a community made up of Jews and Gentiles together, that he's making the case in the way that he's telling the story that is that they have grown out of the soil of Israel's story. He seems to be saying, you are a community that has come into being because the God of Israel entered into history through the Messiah to fulfill the scriptural promises to the Jews, to restore, redeem, and renew. You are a community who recognizes the arrival of the promised work of God and who praises God for it. This is an important aspect of the Gospel of Luke, and who participates in it through the Holy Spirit. So to paint this picture, Luke extensively quotes, alludes to, and mimics the Old Testament, and that's what we're going to look at now. So I want to jump into looking at this theme of inside out. Oh, and by the way, before we get into the text, I want to say I was looking for a couple years ago, a sort of catchy way of thinking about the theme that we're looking at today, and I came up with Inside Out, which I thought was very clever. And then Pixar came along and stole, or was it Disney? I don't know. Anyway, one of them came along and stole the term from me. So if you've seen that movie, it's a very cute movie, but it's about what goes on inside our heads and how that affects the outside of us. That's not what I'm talking about at all. What I mean by inside out is that in Luke's story, the promises of God are fulfilled from the inside out. The kingdom inaugurated by Jesus begins at home with the Jews. They've been long expecting God's redemption. Now it has arrived. The restoration happens first for those inside the Jews, and only when the people of God experience refreshing and renewal by the Spirit, then it goes outward to the rest of the world. So that's what I mean by inside out. Okay, so let's look at the, if you have your New Testament, would like to look at that, I will be reading what I'm referring to, so you don't need to. But if you'd like to, we're going to be in chapter 1. So Julie Andrews once sang, "Let's start at the very beginning," a very good place to start. You remember that? That's true not only in when you're singing, but also with literature, right? So with literature, the way you start, the way you decide to start a story really sets the tone. Luke starts with a little preface, which I'm not going to look at today, but then he immediately goes into the story of Jesus' birth and the story of his cousin John's birth. And when we look at the story, you see so many echoes of Israel's story. There are so many in there that I could do the rest of this lecture on chapter 1 and still not cover all of it. I mean, it's amazing. But let's look at a couple of these. So if you look at 1:16, if you're following along, the angel tells Zechariah that his wife Elizabeth will give birth to a son who will, quote, bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God. So those words, I think, obviously remind us of the promises in the prophets that God would restore Israel. When Zechariah doubts the angel's words, you remember this? In 1:18, he says, "How will I know that this is so?" Zechariah is practically quoting Abraham from Genesis here. It's really interesting. And of course, his story has a lot of parallels with Abraham, right? He has an aging wife who can't, they don't have any children, they get a miraculous pregnancy. So that's an instance where we don't have a citation, but we have kind of a mimicry, or Luke is telling the story in such a way that we're meant to think about the story of Abraham. And in fact, one person who has worked on this has counted 23 such parallels between Abraham and what's going on in Luke 1 to 2. So that's what I mean. It's just steeped in these stories. Now, if we go to the words of the angel to Mary, this is 1:33, if you're following along. She will have a son who will be given, quote, the throne of his ancestor David, who will reign over the house of Jacob forever, right? This is that language of the restoration of Israel. Or if we go to 1:45, which is where Mary starts responding to the announcement that she has received and her visit to Elizabeth. Oh, and by the way, speaking of Julie Andrews, a lot of people say that the beginning of the Gospel of Luke is like a musical, because people are going along, they're, you know, interacting with, you know, and then all of a sudden they just break into song, right? So this is what happens to Mary, right? So imagine her, you know, Julie Andrews, The Hills Are Alive, and that's our Mary. So Mary breaks into song, and she says, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior." This is the famous Magnificat, right? But a few verses later in the song, in 1:51, she describes this great reversal accomplished by God. She says, "Rulers are brought down, the humble have been lifted up, the hungry have been filled." She's speaking as if this has already happened, but most interpreters see this as a kind of anticipatory song. In other words, because the angel has visited her, because the Messiah is going to be born, she can anticipate that this has already happened, even though he hasn't actually arrived yet. So it's a kind of anticipatory language of what is going to happen. God, she's singing that God is breaking into history to redeem and to restore. The kingdom of God has been inaugurated, and it's as if it's these reversals then have already occurred. Notice she goes on to say that he has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise made to our ancestors, to Abraham and his descendants forever. So this is just some sampling of this very rich language at the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. And what the Zechariah will use a word called the word visitation. But this is the visitation of God. This is a word from the prophets, and it's almost code language for the fact that God is breaking in to fulfill these promises to Israel. And so Mary and the other characters are interpreting the birth of Jesus as the arrival of this divine help. So we could look at others, but I'm not going to. Elizabeth, Anna. But let's do pause with Simeon and see what Simeon says. So this is Luke 2:28. If you're looking at it, if you're following along, or actually 2:30. So you have to imagine Simeon. He has been kind of waiting for the restoration of Israel, for the redemption of Jerusalem, and then this family comes in, and he's holding the baby Jesus in his arms, and he also breaks into song. And he says at one point, "Now my eyes have seen your salvation." This is the baby, right? And then verse 32, what is this salvation? So it's Jesus, who is a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to your people Israel. So let's talk about light for a minute here. A light for revelation to the Gentiles. Have you ever been in a really, really dark room, like a cave, or maybe the electricity's gone out or something, and you can't see anything, and you light just one little candle or one little match? Isn't it amazing how deeply that light, even though it's so tiny, can penetrate into that room? I mean, so light can penetrate, right? Light can reveal. Light can take something that's in darkness and reveal something to it. So that's what's going to happen for the Gentiles. They're in darkness. They don't know God. And that light is going to, this light will eventually reveal that to them. But that doesn't happen until Acts. So we don't have to deal with it today because we're looking at the Gospel of Luke. So let's move on to the other thing that light can do. And that is that light can transform something. It can brighten it. It can shine it up, right? I once had this experience. I don't know if you've had this experience before. I was on an airplane, and we were flying over pretty barren. It looked like pretty barren kind of mountains, like, you know, in California, not like lush mountains back in the east or something, you know, but not very. But there was something about the way the light was working that when the plane would get to just a certain point, the light from my vision would hit these little tiny streams, and they would all of a sudden light up. And you could see these itty-bitty streams. Has this ever happened to you on a plane? And then you'd go a little bit further, and it would disappear. And then I kept watching, and then, you know, 30 seconds more, here comes another one. And you would never know that there were these little, they must have been tiny little streams down there, but the light was catching it just the right way. So light kind of can transform something. So the Jews, the people of God, glory for your people Israel, they already know God, right? But they're going to receive glory through the Messiah. So you have two things happening, and really the way I see Luke Acts as a whole is that up to, from Luke 1:1 to about Acts 5 or so, maybe depending on how you think about it through Acts 8, you see this glory coming to Israel. And then the story will shift and turn, and you'll see the light of revelation then going out to the Gentiles. Now, this word glory, you could take it in a political sense. And really, if you think about David being restored to the throne and Israel being restored in a kind of political way, glory would make sense that way. And that is probably what a lot of the expectations were in the first century. What a lot of the readers of Luke, if they didn't know the story already, would maybe think as they're reading Mary's words. And then they get to this word glory. But what Luke is going to do is he's going to define glory in a different way, I think. He in Luke 1 to 2, when the shepherds, you know, the shepherds receive the announcement, it says that this glory comes from the presence of the Lord and surrounds them. So glory in the story of Israel can be very closely associated with the divine presence, the presence of God. So if you think about Moses up on Mount Sinai, when he gets that little glimpse of God, you know, sort of as God passes by, not a full, he can't see God, but he gets this little tiny kind of glimpse. It's the glory of God that he sees. So this glory, Luke seems to be explaining, is glory that comes from the presence of the Lord. It's going to refresh and renew Israel. And then ultimately, it's going to be poured out at Pentecost, but we're not there yet. So we have to then think, what's happening in the Gospel of Luke? How is this glory being affecting Israel in the Gospel of Luke, or is it? Because basically, the Gospel's starting out with these very high claims, right? What we've expected to happen is now happening, and so then the question is, does that actually play out? Okay, so to think about that, let's go to Luke 4. You may be familiar with this passage, but here is a very distinctive passage in the Gospel of Luke. 4:14 would be a good place to go if you're tracking along. It does not appear in any other of the Gospels. It's the way that Jesus sort of identifies himself and his whole ministry at the beginning of the Gospel. And so at 4:14, Luke tells us that Jesus is coming back from the temptations in the desert. He's in the power of the Spirit. Now later we'll find out the Spirit and the glory are closely associated, but here we maybe not don't know that yet. And he goes to his hometown synagogue, and you know, he goes to read the assigned portion of the scripture, and he reads Isaiah 61:1, which I will read from Luke. This is Luke 4:18. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. That's a Messiah word. You know, a Messiah is an anointed figure. He has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. So do you hear a very similar language to what we saw with Mary, right? A kind of reversal. People who are oppressed or low are being lifted up. And so then Jesus finishes reading. Everybody's looking at him, waiting for what he's going to say. And he says, today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. So again, a very big claim, right, that this is actually happening. So if you see what Luke is doing is Luke is saying that Jesus has deep roots in the expectations of Israel. Someday the prophets anticipated there would be a time of the Spirit, a time of God's favor and blessing, and at that time there would be these great reversals, much like what we saw in Mary's song, the poor, captives, the blind, the oppressed. And this is happening now, Jesus says. So he's bringing to fruition all the hopes that are, or the hopes that are embedded in the story of Israel, and long expected by the Jewish people. So keep that in mind, and then we can go a couple of chapters later into chapter 7, 7:19, and John's disciples come to Jesus because they're not 100% sure if Jesus is the Messiah, which is kind of a funny moment in the gospel, but still. They come to him, and they're not sure, and they say, are you the one who is, let me get this right, are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another, right? And the way that Jesus answers is he basically says, well, look around. You know, what do you see happening? And then he goes on to say, the blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the good news brought to them. So Jesus is identifying these miracles that are happening through his ministry as signs that he is the Messiah, which Luke has also then shown us to be connected with this glorification of Israel, right? So the miracles in Luke are not just acts of compassion from Jesus. They are acts of compassion, but they're not just acts of compassion. They are reversals that are in the process of bringing glory to God's people. Or at least that's the thesis that I'm proposing to you. It's not unique to me, but there are differences of opinion on this. Okay, so they are part and parcel of the divine restoration, and they symbolize the restoration of glory to Israel. In chapter 10, Jesus will say, the kingdom has come near to you. So the kingdom is not something far away or elusive. It's not something that comes when Jesus returns. It's now, and it's happening on the pages of the Gospel of Luke. Okay, so if that's true, then we would expect to see some reversal moments actually play out on the pages of the Gospel of Luke. And so I think there are a lot of these, and I wanted to share three of them with you. So we're going to look at three what I'm calling reversal moments. Later in Acts, we'll have similar things, but there I'll call them resurrection moments. Right? So in a sense, you have reversal moments that become essentially resurrection moments later. So let's look at three of these. All three of these are unique to the Gospel of Luke. So let's start with chapter 7. verse 11. This is the story of the widow at Nain, whose son has died, if you're familiar with the story. And Jesus is passing through and kind of comes upon the funeral. So it's a really sad story. The widow is weeping over the body of her only son. And Luke tells us that Jesus has compassion on her, and he tells her not to cry. So he interacts with her, cares about her. And then he touches the bier, the thing that the body is laying on, and says, "Young man, I say to you, get up." Now talk about reversals, right? This is the greatest reversal of death to life. One scholar says, "The resurrection displays the authority and power of the kingdom over death itself." And of course, it prefigures for us what will happen in the resurrection with Jesus, although that is a much greater thing than what Jesus does here. So it's a great reversal. Now, if you know the story of Israel, then you might be thinking of the story of Elijah interacting with the widow at Zarephath. And the stories are very similar. Both texts describe widows who are poor and have only one son. Both Jesus and Elijah, after resuscitating the sons, are described as giving him to his mother. So it's almost as if Luke is imitating that story as he tells this new one. One difference is that Elijah stretches himself out over the body and gives this heartfelt prayer to God, whereas Jesus just touches the body, touches the bier and says something. So you could make the case that as Luke uses intertextuality here, he's mimicking Elijah's story. So he's essentially saying Jesus is like Elijah, right? But also he's saying Jesus is greater than Elijah, right? Because Jesus does this in a different kind of way. You might also know that the book of Malachi promises that Elijah the prophet would come before the great and terrible day of the Lord. So Elijah is closely associated with these expectations of the restoration of Israel. So there's lots of intertextuality here that reminds us as we read the story that you have two things going on. You have a miracle that's happening, but you also have a story that could be understood as a moment of this glorification of the people of Israel, right? Now, if you go on in the story, there's a little more evidence, I think, that helps us say that maybe that is what's going on. Because if you look at 7:16, notice how the people respond, right? They observe this miracle, and what do? They glorify God. It might say praise God in your translation, but the word underlying that is to glorify God. So if you think about it, you have the glory of the Lord shining down on the people of Israel, glorifying them, and then in response, they see what God is doing, and they offer glory back to God, right? And notice what they say. They say, "A great prophet has risen among us, and God has looked favorably on his people." I don't know what your translation says, but that's that word visitation. God has visited his people. So Luke is very careful in how he in the details that he includes for us, right? So that we know that these people are praising God because they recognize that what was promised is occurring. Okay, so that is one story. Let's do two more, and then I will try and offer some reflections on some of the implications of this for us today. Because I want to move it to our modern time period. So the second story is one of my absolute favorites in the Gospel of Luke. It is the story of the bent-over woman who is straightened. This is in Luke 13. It starts at 13:10. And this woman, Jesus is teaching in the synagogue on the Sabbath. And there appears a woman who has a spirit that has crippled her for 18 years. She's bent over, so I think we have to imagine her as very bent over and unable to straighten up. And when Jesus sees her, he calls her over, and notice what he says. He doesn't say, "Woman, you are healed." He could say that, right? But he says, Woman, you are set free from your ailment. Do you hear the resonances of Mary's song? You know, people being set free. The resonances of what Jesus says in the Nazareth synagogue, right? That this is the year of the Lord's favor in which people will be set free from oppression. Well, then he gets into a discussion with the synagogue leader about whether this should be done on Sabbath. I'm going to skip a lot of that for sake of time. But when we get down to halfway through 15, he kind of concludes this, and he says, "Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day?" So again, you notice that freedom, right? He calls her a daughter of Abraham. That's very evocative language. And then when he says this, his opponents are put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing. And you know what? I skipped something that was very important because I put my little bracket in the wrong place. Sorry about that. When this is in the middle of verse 13, when Jesus lays his hands on the woman, what does she do? Immediately she stands up straight and begins praising God, just like the response that we saw in the previous story. So very strong reversal images here. I mean, hunched over and straightened up, right? That's a very strong reversal kind of image. And the woman is also described in ways that echo Isaiah 51. So in Isaiah, I won't read Isaiah 51 because they're scattered throughout the long chapter, but basically in this chapter, the prophet sort of uses a metaphor for the people of Israel as a woman who is described in close association with Abraham, right? So it doesn't say a daughter of Abraham, but it suggests that. And this woman is bent over by oppression from her enemies, right? So she's described, this is Israel in exile. This is Israel, in a state of suffering, right? So she's bent over because of oppression by her enemies. But when she is comforted by God, Isaiah says in the future, what will happen to her? She will stand erect and respond with praise. Interesting, right? So does Luke mean for us to hear these echoes? Well, I suppose we can debate this because we can't ever know for sure. But there are quite a few in this particular story that I think, you can make a very good case. And especially that Jesus refers to the woman as the daughter of Abraham and as one who is bound, oppressed in this way. And the fact that she praises God when she straightens up. So, like the previous one, this story functions on two levels. On the one level, you have a story of a woman who's healed because Jesus cares about her. And that's important, right? So that level is important. But you also have this intertextual level that lends a kind of representative quality to the story. The woman comes to represent the oppressed people of Israel who are being lifted up by their Messiah. But notice, in the process, Luke is defining what restoration means. Restoration means being set free from enemies, as in Mary's song, as in a lot of the expectations in the Hebrew, in the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, right? But Luke is suggesting a particular identification of who the true enemy is. In this story, Romans do really, really bad things. There are evil characters, not all of them, but Luke is very balanced. He gives us good and bad Romans, but the bad Romans do really bad things. But I think what he seems to be saying is that although humans play a role in oppression and evil, the one who is ultimately responsible for all kinds of oppression is Satan. That's the real enemy. Death, bodily ills, social injustices, various kinds of hatred and bigotry. We humans get caught up in these things, but the real enemy is Satan. And so with God's visitation through the Messiah, the true enemy has begun to be overcome. So the third example I wanted to offer is the story of the 10 lepers. And for sake of time, I'm not going to go into as much detail as I wanted to originally. So I'll just say that, again, you have characters who are transformed by Jesus, cleansed in this case. And one of them, he comes back, and if you remember, he offers praise to God, right? And he is, in Greek, an allogenes, it's a outsider, and a foreigner. And so you have, so the question is he Israel, or is he considered part of Israel or not, if we're talking about identity, right? From his perspective, probably yes, right? That he would, as a Samaritan, he's a Samaritan, he would be seen as true Israel. From the Judean perspective, at best, he'd probably be seen as on the margins of Israel. And yet, what's interesting is there are expectations in Isaiah that at the time of the restoration, you would have a foreigners come and worship God at the temple. So is Luke using intertextuality again with this story? Is the story representative? If it is, it's really interesting what he's doing with it, because this foreigner is sent by Jesus to the temple, or to go show himself to the priest anyway. And instead, he comes back and he worships God at the feet of Jesus. And if that's what Luke is doing, then in a way, Luke is challenging us as readers to expand our understanding of the place of worship of God. You know, it can happen at the temple, yes, of course, and lots of characters in Luke and Acts go and worship at the temple. But the Messiah, if the Messiah is bringing the glory, the presence of God into Israel, then anywhere where the Messiah is an appropriate place also for worship. I don't know. That one I'm not as clear on. I am still working on how to work out the intertextuality on that one. But that's another example of how you have healing stories or moments, reversal moments in Luke that essentially convey this impression of the restoration of Israel. So we've explored a sampling of some of the layers of intertextuality in Luke, and so I just want to draw out two quick implications for this. One I've been thinking about is our understanding of salvation. When I teach college students, sometimes I'll say to them, okay, if I say the word salvation, what's the first thing that pops into your head? Can you guess what most of them say?
Rescue from pain.
Rescue from pain.
Going to heaven.
Going to heaven. That's usually the one that I hear, right? It means I'm not going to hell, I'm going to heaven, right? And I mean, I think that's indicative of a larger cultural phenomenon that we have a kind of shallow understanding of salvation. It involves going to heaven, of course. But I mean, it can involve a whole lot more, and especially in the Gospel of Luke and Acts, it does. And I think it's much broader, it's more holistic, and I think we recognize this especially when we read it with our ears tuned to the story of Israel. Because what Luke is doing is he's inviting us into that story. And that we recognize that salvation is not just one thing like going to heaven, but rather it is this whole story of God doing this entire work through the people of Israel and then now through the Messiah to bring healing and restoration and renewal and light into the world. So it's a glory so bright that it accomplishes tremendous reversals for God's people and shines a light of revelation out from them to the ends of the earth. And this all happens through the Messiah because the kingdom has come near. Now, you might be thinking, well, wait a second, there's a little problem there because, you know, not everybody experiences these reversals, right? I mean, we know lots of people who are suffering, and they haven't experienced this reversal. So how can that be right? And I think the way to understand that is that in the Gospel of Luke, what Jesus brings is what theologians call an inaugurated kingdom. It's a kingdom that begins. Things are happening now. The power of Satan is being broken, but it hasn't totally been broken fully yet. So what you may have heard the phrase, a now and not yet kingdom. Something as dramatic and powerful is happening now for the people of Israel, for the Gentiles, but it's also, there's something still in the future when Satan is finally triumphed over. So I think it invites us into an understanding of salvation as being part of this whole story. Restoration, healing, sight, wholeness, cleansing, release from sin, inclusion, justice, and life. All of that is salvation. And I think this theme of inside out also speaks to the issue of our identity and mission today. That inside out theme, while it creates unity, it doesn't obliterate differences. It appreciates and recognizes the special role of the people of Israel, and they're restored and redeemed so that the rest of the world can experience the revelation of this light of Jesus. And I think for us today, I think that can remind us that whatever our unique identity is, it might be our nationality, our ethnicity, it could be our religious experiences and traditions. To have unity or to have a sense of openness to the world, we don't have to leave those behind, but we also need to be open with humility to God, to through the Spirit, to glorify us in the sense of transforming us, changing us, challenging us, making us better, whoever the us is that we're talking about, so that then that glory can reflect outward then to the rest of the world. So I think it's a nice or helpful framework for thinking about specificity as our specific identity, but also how our identity then is a springboard for God's work in the world, that God will work through our specific identity. So that's what I have to share with you today, and I used up all my time, but if anybody wants to stay around, I'm happy to address questions or discuss anything that I just mentioned. Thank you.